This is a rebroadcast of a show that we first aired last fall.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone, and this week, we're all about the music. Everything that's gone wrong in the news business went wrong first in the music business, at least the part that has to do with digital technology and the fact that the stuff we used to pay for, we can now get easily for free. And we have an anniversary of sorts to hang our exploration on. Exactly 10 years ago this fall, recording industry execs had to confront what many saw as a cancer on their business model— a peer-to-peer file-sharing service known as Napster. So, that's the setup. But we've decided to let public radio and TV reporter Rick Carr guide the hour. He's been studying precisely this issue for a dozen years. So, Rick, take it away.
In 1999, the major record labels were Livin' La Vida Loca. They sold about $13 billion worth of music. Last year, just $8 billion. The industry's troubles started exactly 10 years ago this fall. Back then, most people didn't know what an MP3 was. There was no satellite radio, no internet radio. There was no Apple iTunes music store because there were no iPods. But there was a new piece of software written by a college kid in Boston that let people copy one another's music collections without paying. In the summer of 1999, Napster had only a few thousand users, but the record label's trade association was already getting nervous. A couple months later, nearly a million people were using the software. So Hillary Rosen, who was at the time the head of the Recording Industry Association of America, or RIAA, gathered her members together to discuss filing a lawsuit. But first, she signed on to Napster to play a little game.
So you had the heads of all of the record companies in the country sitting around the table naming songs, their newly released hit songs and their back catalog songs, and every single song was available that people named on Napster by the time we ended up filing that litigation.
So wait, let me make sure I've got this right. You're sitting there in a boardroom at RIAA headquarters.
It was actually at the Four Seasons Hotel in Los Angeles.
Okay, at the Four Seasons Hotel in Los Angeles. And you're sitting there with a PC running Napster to demonstrate to the heads of the labels that all of their stuff is out there.
All of their stuff was out there. You don't need to read legal briefs to all of a sudden have some alarmist view about that. All you needed to do was be in that room. Having said that, the other fantastic thing was all of these people are huge music fans, right? So there was this definite vibe that, oh my God, this is so cool. And why aren't we doing this? There were many of us who were kind of heartbroken that we were starting out in such an adversarial position with them. And I think that heartbreak kind of lasted for the next 2 years when the companies didn't sign a deal, couldn't get to a deal, and ultimately Napster got shut down. I think it's still the best music delivery system that anyone has seen.
It almost sounds like you're saying it was kind of a lost opportunity.
Well, it was a lost opportunity. It's not widely known how serious and prolonged the efforts were to actually take advantage of Napster and have licensing and have it be something that the industry embraced. It just didn't happen. There was just never enough money to go around in the nascent days of online music to make people feel like they were going to get enough to pay for the future.
Now, back to the present. Things aren't a whole lot better. Some online music services are still the targets of lawsuits, just like Napster was. And the labels and online music entrepreneurs are still arguing about money. Tim Quirk's been hip deep in the business the whole time. He started out as a musician, playing in the major label band Too Much Joy. But since the late 90s, he's been trying to create a legal online music service that's as good as Napster was back in the day. Quirk is vice president of music programming for Rhapsody, which offers its subscribers unlimited access to music for a monthly fee. He says the problem is that the major labels are still, 10 years later, motivated primarily by fear.
They know what their catalog was worth in the past. They know what it's worth today. They do not know what its future value will be. So their job is to maximize its present-day value. And any new business model that comes along, their default assumption is that it's going to screw up their business somewhere else. The big fear is not so much a loss of money as a loss of control. The system before worked for a few. It made a few very, very, very wealthy. And every time there is a new business model success in the music industry, the copyright owners tend to get resentful about it. So MTV was a huge success. Labels still hate MTV because they felt like MTV was building a business on their backs. You hear a lot of the same kind of talk with the success of iTunes. Even though it's putting big paychecks in the record company coffers, they're still upset that it's got so much power over them.
The major labels say, don't be so quick to point the finger. Jonathan Lamy's a senior spokesperson for the RIAA. He says record labels weren't the only ones with their hands out.
If you want to develop a new business model, you need the record companies to okay their rights. You need the music publishers who represent songwriters, who also own a right within each song that you hear. Often you need artists who have, perhaps within their contracts, the ability to okay or not okay a new business model. So there are lots of different players within the industry. That said, the basic point that I think everybody appreciates now is that we are here, we're online, we're making our music available in lots and lots of different ways. We're trying to encourage fans to turn to those sites because that really is our future.
You've still got that huge problem, though, of the unpaid services. You've still got BitTorrent out there, which by some accounts is the largest source of traffic on the internet right now. Is it still as big a problem as it was 10 years ago? And if so, what do you do to get people to stop doing it?
It still is an enormous problem, but I think we've had more success than sometimes people recognize. If you look back over the last 10 years, the sites that formerly profited from facilitating theft have either gone out of business or become legitimate. The second point I would make is that we recognize we will always live with a degree of people taking music. We did that in the physical world when you had bootlegging. The idea here is at least to try and keep it at a manageable level so that legitimate businesses like iTunes and Rhapsody and Amazon and all the others, iMeme, can really take root and flourish.
One of the other things that you've done to try to combat these services is actually file lawsuits against some of the music fans who've used them.
Last December, we officially announced that we would end the litigation program against end users. 4 or 5 years ago, when we first started the program, we felt like we had no choice. We were facing a culture of people who just were unaware of the law, despite all of the educational efforts that we'd made. We did polling, you know, a few months after we started the program and saw that the number of people who appreciated that there was a law and that you could break the law and get in trouble had gone from like 33% to something like 75%. But it was never designed to be a panacea.
Now, there are other ways to get people to stop downloading music and not paying for it. One method that's been successful in Europe is an online service that streams whatever music you want to hear to your computer, kind of like an internet radio station with a request line that's always open, so you always get to pick what's next. It's called Spotify, and again, in Europe, because it's not available here, it's incredibly popular.
It's kind of a magical feeling the first time you try this service. I started rediscovering music again. It's so effortless to check something out.
That's Elliot Van Buskirk, who writes about online music for Wired.com. The best thing about Spotify, he says, is the price.
It's free in Europe. They'll play you an audio ad, and the audio ad syncs up with a video ad that they display at the same time. And then the hope is that you will pay to upgrade for 10 euros a month. This is the genius part of it. They hook you with this unlimited free music service, and there's sharing, and it's great. Now you want to plug something in with headphones and walk out the door and listen to it on your mobile device, like an iPhone. You have to be a premium subscriber.
Why does it seem so much easier for entrepreneurs and people who create software like this to launch these products in Europe?
There's different rights organizations in Europe that apparently have taken a different stance towards how much they should charge for somebody that streams a song. I've heard estimates that they pay a tenth what they would pay to do the same in the States. And so we see all kinds of strange differences where our friends in Europe are able to share playlists, email each other URLs to listen to a song. You can even take it a step further and set the playlist to be collaborative so that you and your friends can edit the playlist, they can delete the whole thing, do all this stuff that we can't do.
So, if you're an online music entrepreneur, in the U.S. at least, even 10 years after Napster, it's still not such a good time. And if you work for a record label, if you manage to keep your job, that is, it's decidedly not a good time. And if you're a record retailer, it is emphatically not a good time. But Tim Quirk of the music subscription service Rhapsody says the rest of us, fans and musicians, are better off than we were 10 years ago.
Far better off. It's almost a paradise. As a listener, it means you've got access to almost anything you want to hear, almost anywhere you are, almost whenever you want. If you're an artist, labels are now an option, not a necessity. You can go direct to fans if you want to. Even if you do opt to go with a label, you can get, depending on the label, you can get much better terms than you used to be able to get because nobody's got a lock on distribution anymore.
So what happens next? I mean, 10 years from now, where do you think the music business is?
I will make a prediction. Music as a service is what the average person will take for granted 10 years from now. The question, and this is where the hope comes in, is whether it will be unlicensed services that aren't compensating anybody or whether they will be licensed services that somehow people are paying money. You know, paying a monthly subscription fee to Rhapsody is one way. Paying a little bit extra to your ISP for the right to not get sued when you're downloading music off of peer-to-peer services is another way. I can't predict what the outcome will be, but there's just so much resistance on the part of the copyright owners to creating sustainable deal terms.
You mean, in other words, that they're asking for too much money from you and you can't recoup that from your users?
And not just us personally. I mean, I've seen it with every music service because, like I said, it took 10 years to sell MP3s, even though the marketplace had demonstrated that this was the format of choice back in 1999. That's when MP3 first overtook sex as the top search term on Yahoo.
10 years on, the record industry's still trying to figure out how to capitalize on that interest. Quirk says until it does, fans will just keep doing what they've been doing since 1999, getting music online without paying for it. You got the music in you. Don't let go. You got the music in you. One dance left. This world is gonna pull through. Don't give up. Coming up, an argument over a different kind of theft or borrowing. Fair use or something. Basically, it's an argument over what is art. This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Rick Carr. 10 years ago, Napster ignited the fight over what recording executives call piracy. 20 years ago, a lawsuit sparked a fight over another kind of so-called theft, what recording artists call sampling. What happened in 1989 submerged hip-hop into a kind of legal limbo from which some fascinating questions arise, such as, why hasn't Greg Gillis been sued? OTM producer Jamie York looked into that mystery and emerged with an update on the still underground art of sampling.
Greg Gillis is now a professional musician. After years of being a Pittsburgh biomedical researcher by day and a DJ by night, he's quit his day job and turned to DJing full-time. Well, not exactly DJing. Gillis, using the moniker Girl Talk, both performs and records songs that are built from the raw material of top 40 music. He's sampling. Greg Gillis.
I basically take pre-existing pop songs and I cut them up and rearrange them and collage them together and try to manipulate them in a way that it becomes something new. Try to make new pop out of old pop.
Play your part.
It starts off with drums from Roy Orbison's Pretty Woman. Then you would hear a verse from a UGK song. And then you would hear a bass line from Spencer Davis Group. And then you would hear drums that I program myself with drum machines, and you would hear hand claps that come from an Afrika Bambaataa song. So it's kind of like that, enough to get a pace of 300 songs in like 50 minutes or so.
Gillis would be the first person to admit he isn't doing anything radically new. He's just doing it as well as anyone out there.
I think you could say that a generation that had grown up playing with samples was eventually going to find its master impresario.
James Boyle is a law professor at Duke.
What he did was kind of different in that he was doing it, first of all, from a laptop, so There's just something so wonderfully sweet and nerdy about watching a sweaty guy with his shirt off playing at the trackpad of a laptop with a complicated music sampling program on it while hordes of screaming women besiege him from the sides. I think this is every nerd's dream come true. So Gillis, I think, moves this to the next step. Able to just tickle the ears of his listeners. They're like, oh, I love that beat. And then something else would come and you're like, wow, they're really the same. They fit together. That was really the key to the success of the art form and made him really this extraordinary success. First, I think largely on college campuses and then way beyond it. Hey, bring your back low. She do it with no
hands. Now stop popping roll. Skills aside, part of the enormous attention the media has paid to Gillis is because he may very well be breaking the law. Law that was supposed to be established around sampling nearly 20 years ago. To explain why he takes the risk, we go where Gillis first got his taste for sampling.
I grew up listening to a lot of hip-hop, so it's like if you listen to Public Enemy, Bomb Squad production, you hear hundreds of samples kind of coming and going, and I like that whole aesthetic. It's like a dense wall of rhythm, and it just has this energy to it. Here come the drums!
Gillis is paying tribute to Hank Shockley, the founder and leader of the so-called Bomb Squad, which created the music for the rap group Public Enemy. What you're hearing now is a song called Can't Trust It, and it's what? After 20 years of listening to it, I think it's made up of samples from James Brown, Sly and the Family Stone, the Lafayette Afro Rock Band, Slave, George Clinton, Run DMC, and a trove of things unknown. Hip-hop had begun with a DJ and two turntables playing the funkiest parts of records, the breakbeats, and had evolved by the late 80s to this, a kind of sonic architecture built piecemeal out of hundreds of carefully mined bits of sound. It's a Saturday night in October in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, and Hank Shockley is DJing an art opening. 20 years after producing Can't Trust It, he's not exactly sure what's in it, or he's not telling. But what he was trying to do couldn't be clearer.
And one of the reasons why we sample is because we want to get that natural vibe that was originally recorded in the record. You could re-record those things, but you won't get the exact vibe because you're talking about a time where people was recording records a totally different way than they do today. So we're sampling records from the 70s, and we're looking for just a bit, a snatch of something that we can sit there and go, okay, this thing is edgy, it's dark, what is it communicating? We will find something in a Tony Bennett record, Charlie Pride, if it's Turkish music, we'll find something. You might find a kick in the snare comes from a classical record. You truncate what you want, and then you turn it into whatever, taking a car door slam, and that will become a snare.
Then, in the midst of his heyday with Public Enemy, Shockley was told that what he was doing was suddenly illegal.
As guys started becoming more and more blatant with the sampling, and the record started selling more and more, the producers and writers and publishers started demanding royalties. And then it became a business.
In 1989, the group De La Soul were sued by The Turtles for a lengthy sample. They settled out of court. In 1991, hip-hop artist Biz Markie was successfully sued for this song, Alone Again, by Gilbert O'Sullivan for the use of his song, Alone Again Naturally. It's fair to say that Biz Markie was one of the blatant guys that Shockley just referred to. He rapped over a whole song. Samplers like Shockley suffered the consequences. The effect of these cases was devastating, especially for a community of hip-hop artists just getting their first tastes of success. Duke Law professor James Boyle says the Biz Markie case in particular was a sloppy solution to a complex problem.
The case was decided by a judge who actually ended up never really referring to the Copyright Act at all. In fact, he referred to the Old Testament and Thou Shalt Not Steal rather than to the rather more complex and nuanced framework of the Copyright Act in assessing it. It was very poorly reasoned, if it was reasoned at all. But the thing that the judge said in the end is, you know, basically this stuff is theft, period. End of story.
Copyright law, as complex as it is, makes allowances for artistic borrowing, a doctrine known as fair use. Are you using the borrowed bit commercially? If so, did you transform it in some way? Did you take a sizable portion of the original, the heart of it? And will your use have an effect on the market for the original song? These are the legal questions designed to be applied to music sampling, and yet, astoundingly,
We really have never had a rich fair use discussion about sampling and hip-hop inside a courtroom, which is remarkable. Instead, we just have a set of industry practices of people paying licenses pretty much for any amount of the work, no matter how trivial.
Jazz, to use just one example from an older artistic tradition, samples too, but seems legally immune. Perhaps all hip-hop needs is time.
This is a form of music that is very familiar to a generation, none of whom are federal district court judges. If Greg Gillis were now being inducted into the Musicians Hall of Fame, and you had 50-something people talking about the golden days of the sampling revolution on NPR, then I think we'd be in great shape because the judges would say, oh, this is a great American cultural form.
That time, though, is something Hank Shockley is not going to get back. 20 years of clearance culture took the rainbow palette of an audio artist, like Shockley. This is How to Kill a Radio Consultant from 1991. And reduced him to monochrome, a single expensive color courtesy of a well-known song, because that's all he could afford. 20 years after first being deemed illegal, hip-hop sampling thrives underground. Fueled by digital technology and the internet, there have been a few notable successes among this latest generation. Greg Gillis, who you heard at the start of this piece, and especially 2004's DJ Danger Mouse, who created what he called the Grey Album, a mix of Jay-Z's Black Album and the Beatles' White Album. They say they never really miss you till you dead or you gone. So on that note, I'm leaving after the song. So you ain't gotta feel. The Grey Album made Danger Mouse a star. Never commercially released, it leaked far and wide, making a number of year-end top 10 lists and offering major labels an object lesson in how not to stop samplers. I asked at the beginning why Greg Gillis hasn't been sued yet. In fact, Danger Mouse may be why. James Boyle.
There's the story that the labels learned from DJ Danger Mouse and don't want to risk creating the Che Guevara of the digital sampling age, the lost hero to which all of us will offer reverence and thus make him even more popular. Another story is they're going, this is really interesting. Let's let him run a bit. And when we finally see how things are playing out, then we'll figure out a way of getting a revenue stream out of this. Third story is they realize it's actually fair use and they don't want a bad precedent brought against them. And then a fourth one is that they are gibbering in terror and are so scared by this new phenomena they're incapable of rational action of any kind and so are caught in a kind of fugue state as the digital music scene develops.
So which is it?
If you went around the music industry and asked people, why haven't you sued him? You would get all of those answers.
Boyle and Shockley and Gillis are all quick to point out that they're not anti-copyright. They'd love a world in which paying for samples is simple and fair, but that's not the world they've got. The cost and risk of sampling has fundamentally changed a whole genre of music. And yet, Greg Gillis is likely playing his hundreds of samples somewhere tonight, probably shirtless, probably for adoring women, and he's going to keep claiming fair use. He doesn't know why he hasn't been sued, but he's decided to embrace that riddle of his career, that the more successful he gets, the more attention he's paid, and the more likely he is to be a legal target. Maybe he'll be the first to make the fair use argument in court, but with the ranks of samplers swelling every day, he certainly won't be the last. For On the Media, I'm Jamie York. And here's Pennsylvania Congressman Mike Doyle on the House floor in 2007.
Mr. Chairman, I want to tell you a little story of a local guy done good. His name's Greg Gillis, and by day he's a biomedical engineer in Pittsburgh. At night he DJs under the name Girl Talk. His latest mashup record made the top albums of 2006 lists from Rolling Stone, Pitchfork, and Spin Magazine, amongst others. His shtick, as the Chicago Tribune wrote about him, is, quote, based on the notion that some sampling of copyrighted material, especially when manipulated and recontextualized into a new art form, is legit and deserves to be heard.
Now I'm in the limelight cause I rhyme tight, time and get paid. Blow up like the World Trade. Born sinner, the opposite of a winner. Remember when I used to eat sardines for dinner? Peace to Ron G, Brucey B, Kid Capri, Funk Master Flex, Love Bug Star Ski.
Most musicians historically have never actually earned their livings by selling records or downloads. Only the top superstars ever got rich off of royalties. Instead, most musicians have earned their livings by putting butts in seats, playing live, touring. But the concert business has been going through some pretty substantial changes, too. Let's go back to 1975 when the Rolling Stones recorded this concert album, Love You Live. Yeah, I'm about to stick my pen in my heart. Spending all over the stage. You could have seen the group that had already declared itself the world's greatest rock and roll band for $8.50. That's $8.50. In today's terms, that's just $34. By comparison, the last time Mick and Keith and the boys hit the road 4 years ago, most tickets were $100. In other words, three times as much. Some longtime observers of the concert business say there's a good reason for that spike in ticket prices. Back in 75, the Stones played in 26 cities in North America. That meant that 26 different concert promoters handled the shows. But through the 80s and 90s, a couple of mega promoters started to buy up their smaller rivals nationwide. John Schur has been promoting rock shows since the 1970s. He's worked with everyone from the Grateful Dead to Liza Minnelli, mostly in the Northeast. He says fans are paying more because the consolidated promotion conglomerates beat their local rivals by paying more to artists.
Say there was a XYZ artist, and that artist was normally seeking a guarantee of $250,000 a night to do an arena tour. Well, these consolidated companies were saying, well, look, if you give us the whole tour and you play where we want you to, we'll pay you $350,000 a show.
In the end, one company out-consolidated all the others. SFX Entertainment. Before long, it was acquired by broadcasting giant Clear Channel Communications. But Schur says bigger wasn't better. Those publicly traded firms couldn't please both concertgoers and their investors on Wall Street. So Clear Channel sold off its concert arm in 2005. It's now known as Live Nation, and it's been struggling ever since. Its shares are worth less than a third of what they were at their peak. Live Nation's executives think the way out is to merge again, this time with Ticketmaster, home of the so-called convenience charge. Regulators haven't given it the green light yet. They're worried about the merger's impact on ticket prices. Independent concert promoters like John Schur say going up against Live Nation is already hard enough.
You simply can't compete with them. All you can do is choose to be a second-class citizen.
Did they ever come to you and make you an offer? And if they did, why did you say no?
Well, I answer that question one of two ways, whether my wife is listening or she's not. The truth is that they did come to me. They made me very, very good offers. I turned them down, and it was a terrible mistake on my part. Why did I make that mistake? Probably for two reasons. One, I didn't believe in the model. I didn't think it could be profitable, and I didn't really want to be part of something that was unprofitable. Two, I think being in the artist development business, both as a manager and as a concert producer, has historically done well for us, although not of late. And, you know, we thought that we could carry on. What's terrible about it is forget the promoters. It's the public. When you're looking at $250 and $500 tickets as being the norm for big shows, and if, you know, you're going to spend $250 to see the Rolling Stones or to see U2 or to see Madonna or Paul McCartney or, you know, any of the giant acts, that's probably the one concert you can afford to go to all year.
Doesn't something have to give at some point, though? I mean, these artists aren't going to be on the road forever. At some point, you know, Paul McCartney is going to say, I can't tour anymore of the Stones. I'm assuming at some point Mick and Keith are going to say, we can't tour anymore. Won't the market correct itself at some point?
Well, there's no question that something's going to give, and I think we're right on the edge of that. I just earlier today had a conversation with a facility manager who had historically had an arena that was doing 50 to 60 shows a year. This year, it's going to be under 40. It's a direct result of there are less and less big acts. Used to be, as the older acts retired, broke up, God forbid, died, They were younger up-and-coming acts. But if you look now at what are considered the sort of younger superstars, you know, you look at Radiohead, you look at Coldplay, you're looking at acts that have been around for 15 years. There's very few, very, very few artists that have become arena or amphitheater headliners with any staying power. There are every year a couple of artists, often in the urban world, that become very, very big for a short period of time. But the American Idol model, it's about now, not about 3 or 4 or 5 years from now. So will it correct itself? I think it'll correct itself, but there'll be the dark ages of the concert promotion business probably for anywhere from 5 to 10 years.
John Schur, thanks a lot for joining us.
Nice to have chatted with you.
John Schur is co-CEO of Metropolitan Entertainment, a concert and live event promotion firm in New York City. By the way, the Rolling Stones' Love You Live and 4 other concert albums by the band are about to be reissued by Universal Music. You'll probably be able to pick up all 5 for less than the cost of a single seat on their next tour. Coming up, the changing definition of success. It's not about how many fans love you, but about how much they love you. This is On the Media from NPR. This is a rebroadcast of a show that we first aired last fall.
Support for On the Media comes from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Rick Carr. Every documentary about a musician or episode of VH1's Behind the Music has that shot in it. You know the one I'm talking about. You hear about the band's breakout success while the camera shoots up a music chart and finally rests at their hit song, number 3 with a bullet. The chart you're seeing is probably Billboard's iconic Hot 100. It's a monument to stardom that's starting to crumble. That's because it measures radio airplay and record sales when a lot fewer people are listening to radio and buying records than in the early days of the charts. Yes, the Hot 100 does include data from the AOL and Yahoo streaming services, but that makes up just 3% of its data. OTM producer Mark Phillips charts the chart's struggle for relevance in the turbulent music ecosystem.
Billboard created the Hot 100 in 1958 by combining record sales and radio plays to come up with the definitive list of what was popular.
Three Dog Night. They're the hottest act on the charts at the moment. They've got the number 1 song for the 3rd week in a row. Joy to the World. Jeremiah was
a bullfrog. The charts helped radio stations compose their playlists, and record labels decide which bands deserved expensive promotional campaigns. They factored into how much musicians got paid and influenced young music fans. In other words, charts were a big deal.
There was a sense of, well, these authority figures are telling me that this music is really good, therefore I should check it out.
Greg Kot is a music critic for the Chicago Tribune and author of the book Ripped, How the Wired Generation Revolutionized Music.
In fact, what was going on behind the scenes was simply the payola was flowing in for, you know, a certain single. And that was the record that was going to get played because the radio station saw that as a revenue stream. I think that genuinely affected chart position.
It was possible back in the day to really buy yourself, if not a number 1 record, certainly a top 10 record.
Chris Malamphy is the chart columnist at Idolator.com.
Up until the 1990s, Billboard would call or fax retailers and radio program directors and ask them, what are your top sellers this week? What are your most played records this week? And as you can imagine, that system was exceedingly fudgeable.
So fudgeable that Billboard finally did something about it. In 1990, they started using the broadcast data system, which used computers to count how often songs were actually played on the radio. Yes, it didn't stop payola from outright buying plays, but Chris Malamphy says Billboard went one step further with something called SoundScan.
This was accurate counting at the retail counter of the sales of records. So basically, when you brought a CD or a cassette to the counter and they scanned the barcode, you were in effect voting for a hit record at that very moment. It was being counted. This changed everything.
Virtually overnight, the charts got a whole lot more accurate, and the effects were huge. Chart columnist Chris Malamphy says the music industry responded to the clearer picture of what was popular by promoting not just underappreciated artists, but whole genres.
The two I would point to most particularly are country and hip-hop. The act that SoundScan arguably made was Garth Brooks. The very first week SoundScan came online, his then-current album, No Fences, shot into the top 10. It's widely perceived that the advent of truly accurate counting allowed the industry to perceive just how popular he was for the first time and promote him accordingly. The thunder rolls and the lightning strikes. After that moment, Garth Brooks never looked back. He spent the rest of the 90s scoring number one album after number one album, not just on the country charts, but on the major pop album chart. He was the best-selling act of the 1990s of any genre. On the hip-hop side, dozens of rap albums that weren't performing all that well on the charts were suddenly massive top 10 successes after SoundScan. Within a couple of months after SoundScan's launch, the gangsta rap group NWA scored their first number one album. Prior to that, they'd never even made the top 30. It's inarguable that SoundScan made it much clearer to the industry that hip-hop was not a fad and that it was worthy of major label promotion.
It was a feedback loop. Knowing what was popular helped the industry make it more popular. And so SoundScan technology was put in more and more record stores. If you buy a record in a store today, there's a 90% chance SoundScan is recording your purchase. But if you're a teenager, chances are you don't buy records in stores. Over 50% didn't even buy one CD last year. Greg Kot.
You know, for a generation, probably two generations now, of consumers, buying a piece of recorded music is really kind of foreign to their way of processing music, you know, and enjoying it and considering it popular. So it's much more difficult to pinpoint, here it is, the number one record in the U.S.
The main album chart, the Billboard 200, does include data from some digital music stores like iTunes. But Chris Malamphy says it's still leaving out a lot of young listeners.
As illegal downloading has taken off, whole chunks of the, shall we call it, underground economy are not getting reflected on the chart week after week. 10 years ago at this time, the kinds of albums that were topping the chart regularly were Backstreet Boys, Britney Spears. But we've started to see some albums topping the charts recently that are beloved by probably a middle-aged audience. I'm thinking of Johnny Cash, Bob Dylan, who scored his first number one album in over 30 years with Modern Times, because who are the last people still going to record stores and buying physical albums? People in their 40s, 50s, 60s.
Right. Okay. The one thing that does skew our measurements is that older people buy more music. They steal less music.
Rob Levine is executive editor at Billboard magazine.
So like, you know, a Bruce Springsteen or a Madonna might overperform on the album sales chart relative to some more subjective measure of their popularity. But as far as like, you know, who's stealing what, I mean, of what use is that?
Well, maybe if the music industry took into account all the different ways music is consumed today, they could have a SoundScan-like revelation and start promoting the stuff people really like. But chart columnist Chris Malamphy says they've already tried.
Let's look at OK Go. Here's an act that was succeeding not necessarily illegally, but not entirely traditionally either.
The band OK Go gained fame on YouTube with a clever music video where they danced across six treadmills. It's been watched an astounding 48 million times.
After that viral phenomenon, which wasn't making the industry any money, OK Go's label put more firepower into the band, promoting them more at radio, sending them on tour, all of the things that a record label has it at its disposal to try to make a band bigger.
But it didn't really work. OK Go never became a platinum-level band.
This is what I call the snakes on a plane fallacy. This is really a theory of mine.
Billboard's Rob Levine.
There was a tremendous amount of blog buzz on Snakes on a Plane. A lot of people said, so many bloggers are talking about this. So many fan sites have sprung up about it. I bet that movie is going to be a big hit. But it wasn't that big a hit. It did okay. And I think what we learned from that is things that people do as a hobby or for free is generally not a very good guide to what they will buy. If I told you that what I eat at a buffet would be a good guide to what I order at a restaurant, you would say, that's crazy.
But I think the reality for a lot of people, a lot of young people, is that the buffet is always open.
Yeah, but I'm not in the buffet business. Our charts are viewed as a more definitive measure of popularity for a good reason. What people spend money on is a very good indication of what they value.
There are a number of different ways to define popularity.
Eric Garland is co-founder of the company Big Champagne, which tries to track all the ways music spreads these days.
And if we're just talking about the breadth of the audience and not the depth of interest, I don't think we're really getting at the value of the music.
Big Champagne tracks legal and illegal downloads, streams on MySpace and YouTube, merchandise sold on tours, and so on. Garland says you need all that information to track the fans' passion.
One of the things that we've looked at for a number of years is something that we call songs per fan. How many songs from this artist is the average fan interested in? You know, an artist like the Dave Matthews Band, if someone is interested in one song, they are likely interested in more than five songs. I chose that example because that's a very elite club. You know, I would put the Beatles in that company. But let me put the question to you. If you look at the top of the airplay charts, the top of the sales charts, how many songs on average do you think people are interested in from those artists? Remember that the number can't fall below one, right? It's about 1.1.
It's a mathematical way of saying the average artist on the top of the charts is a one-hit wonder. And Garland says this effectively chops off the top of the charts because one-hit wonders don't make money like they used to. In fact, he says they're so expensive to produce and promote that the real money is with smaller acts, with more devoted followings. But how do you measure devotion?
An artist has to have the tool set to be able to tap into this real-time conversation that's taking place and engage their fan base.
Duncan Freeman is the founder of a website called Bandmetrics, which he plans to launch next year. He showed me how it works by plugging in my band's name. Yes, I play in a band. In one section, a Google map popped up that showed where we're getting radio plays. Another section located the cities where we're getting the most buzz and mapped a potential tour route for us. And then, using natural language processing, Freeman hopes to track Facebook, Twitter, and other social networking sites so bands can effectively identify their biggest fans. You know, the ones who buy things from them.
So we look at fans in essentially four levels. We look at the casual listener that may listen to one or two of your songs. Then there's the fan who listens to your music and they go to a show. The next level up would be the supporter. And these are the folks that are out there talking about your music and who are willing to bring two or three people to see your show when you come to town. And then the highest level, which we call the superfan, these are your evangelists.
The website looks less like a music chart and more like the tools of a web-savvy political campaign. And maybe that's what the chart of the future needs to be, a tool for organizing communities. If it works, it would transform and replace the whole idea of charts. Instead of being a list for the record execs of the top-selling artists, it would be a list for the musicians themselves of their most devoted fans. Kind of cool. Only problem, it just doesn't make a good radio show.
You're tuned to Britain's grooviest radio show, Top of the Pops.
For On the Media, I'm Mark Phillips.
North London, called The Kinks. And it's called The Strange Effect.
Got this strange effect on me, and I like it.
One musician who's had no trouble creating relationships with her fans is Amanda Palmer. She's one half of the band The Dresden Dolls, and their music's been described as Brechtian punk cabaret.
Make believing that I have a soul beneath the surface, trying to convince you, incidentally, on purpose.
Palmer's a former street performer who's apparently got a knack for monetizing her fans' passion. One Friday night earlier this year, Palmer says she was bored, and so she accidentally started a t-shirt project with her fans on Twitter. Just 2 hours of work earned her a whopping $11,000. It's just one of the many ways Palmer has made a living by tapping into her fans' goodwill. The key, Palmer says, is trying out lots of different ways of making money.
Everyone has to stop thinking there's an answer. The answer is there's an infinite number of answers.
You've done some fairly unusual things to raise some money from your fans.
I've done free webcasts in which I've auctioned off props from the videos that I've shot and handwritten song lyrics and weird stuff from my apartment. People have bid hundreds and hundreds of dollars on this stuff, but a lot of it is not even really so much about the stuff itself as it is about their willingness to connect with me and support me. And I've also done a lot of sort of flash mob shows using Twitter and my blog to get a bunch of people in a public space and literally put a hat out and said, I gave you this show for free. I'm really glad you came. If you can afford to give me some money, do it. If you're too poor, don't.
I get the feeling, though, that you may have gotten some flack for this because you wrote a blog post in September that was titled, Why I Am Not Afraid to Take Your Money. Artists have always asked their fans for money. I mean, you know, records came out in the 80s. They were effectively asking you to pay the 10 bucks or whatever it cost to buy the vinyl record.
I think what's important to point out that it was never the artists asking. It was Tower Records or the anonymous record label. It was never Madonna putting her hand out saying, here's my record, give me the money. You know, people kind of don't like it. They want their artists and their musicians to be these sort of like pure beings who are like holed up in garrets wearing scarves and like painting and strumming their guitars and howling in pain. And like some product gets mysteriously delivered and then somebody else who doesn't mind dealing with the money goes out with the hat. Now that you can make music directly available to your fans, I think it's also time to destroy the myth that artists shouldn't ask for money.
Surely there have got to be some downsides to this, though. I mean, nobody's going to give you $500,000 up front to go into the studio and make your record, right? Come on, you're making it sound like
it's
a perfect scenario. But
No. It's definitely not ideal. And one of the advantages that I certainly had with my band, the Dresden Dolls, was that we signed back when it was sort of like the last wave of, you know, here's a bunch of money to make a record. But an album can cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to produce with a gazillion people behind it. Or, you know, someone can pick up a guitar and record it into their Macintosh for $0. But if that person recording their guitar into their Mac and putting it up online sings about something that connects with millions of people, nobody will care what the medium was. All they'll know is that they heard a song that made them cry and they want to hear it again.
People who are fans of yours are truly fanatical. Can every artist expect to tap into their fan base's goodwill the way that you have?
I think the answer is no, not necessarily. I'm really, really lucky I have the kind of fan base who will sort of play around with me and try different experiments. But hopefully once we set up a few things that work, it might be easier for an artist who isn't quite as outspoken or as exhibitionist to say, well, you know, this worked for Amanda and her fans, and, you know, and I'm willing to try it. That's what a lot of bands are doing right now. Radiohead, definitely. Nine Inch Nails. They were willing to put their music out there pretty much for free and say, we're going to let you, the fan, set the price. I think it just sort of made it acceptable.
You may be the only optimistic person we've talked to in the entire music business, because everybody cites 10 years ago, the industry was selling $13.5 billion worth of records. Last year, they only sold $8 billion. And we've heard people say that the live touring industry is collapsing because it's consolidated to the point where it's just unsustainable anymore. And yet, you're sitting here and you're saying, you sound really optimistic.
People don't love music any less. There might be a lot less money out there in the industry, but maybe that's a good thing. Maybe the fact that the live industry is tanking to a certain degree means that ticket prices are now going to be reasonable. As far as the music is concerned, maybe it ups the ante. If you're a teenager with a dream of being a rock star, maybe you'll really think about why. Were you doing this to be rich and famous? Or are you doing this because you really love music and you want to connect with people? And you'll do it even if it just means you make a living wage. If that's true, I'm a fan of the new system.
Amanda Palmer, thanks a lot for coming in to talk to us.
You're so welcome.
Amanda Palmer is a musician, a blogger, an artist, and a member of the band The Dresden Dolls. That's it for this week's special show on the Music Biz. Brooke and Bob, thank you so much for lending me this hour. It's been a blast. On the Media this week was produced by Jamie York and Mark Phillips, with help from Mike Vuolo and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and with more help from James Hover and Dan Mauzy, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. Bob Garfield and Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Rick Carr.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.